Webcasting to the world, live, the good news of God's righteousness for all humanity. This is the Gospel Revolution Radio Network. Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein online. It's hump day, Wednesday, July 29, 2009, the only July 29, 2009 in the history of the world. Welcome in on this edition of the Gospel Revolution webcast. Glad to have you along for the ride, and glad to have along as well, as always, the founder and president of said revolution from the home offices in Houston, Texas, Mr. Michael Williams. Michael!
Good evening, Glenn. How is Florida? Duh.
It is pretty Florida-like in July. Steamy, warm, but we are doing well. We hope you're doing well wherever you are logged in from around the globe. We'd like to thank Greg Ambergy for sitting in last week. Did a fine job, and we want to hear from you tonight. If you're listening live, and it's at the top of the hour, 9 o'clock on the East Coast of the United States of America, you are listening live, and Sean O'Halloran is waiting in studio in our Tampa Bay studio to take your call at 1-800-436-3260, 1-800-436-3260, and whatever you want to talk about, gospel-related, spiritual-related, religious-related, anything is pretty much on the table, as always, as we take your calls at 1-800-436-3260. Your participation is requested. It always makes it a very interesting part of the show when we get your perspectives and your insight and your experiences recorded on this here radio show. So 1-800-436-3260 will get you online with Michael. And also, if you are listening live or on the archive, you can email us at webcast@gospelrevolution.com, webcast@gospelrevolution.com with your questions or comments, and we will get to those either tonight or in the coming weeks, depending on when you email us. Next week, Michael, you will be north of the border, but not in Canada.
North to Alaska. Yep, it's Alaska time. My 50th state in the Union. Jeez, I am... I'm looking forward to this. I hope that I have not waited too late in the summer. It is cooler there already than it was a month ago, because they are already going into their fall. So, yeah, pray for me. I want good weather.
Oh, sure. Now you want us to break out the prayers. When the weather in Alaska is on the line, that's critical.
That's right. Yes, we've got a vacation on the dot here. No, I'll be doing some speaking while I'm there, and they have decided more on because of the group that I'll be speaking with there. They've decided on more impromptu type sessions, which is fine with me. And but definitely going to be getting out and going to the glaciers and Denali Park and possibly a boat trip, a day trip maybe out in the I think it's the Gulf of Valdez, I think it's called. So anyway, yeah, I think it's going to be a it definitely will be an experience. We'll see exactly what kind of an experience it's going to turn out to be. I'm not sure I want to go see a glacier while it's raining, but if I have to, I guess I will.
Well, you may have waited too long or in the summer to go to Alaska, but Governor Sarah Palin knew when to get out.
She did. Boy, her timing was good. Before the rain set in, because I'm beginning to understand now that August is the rainy season that declines into, of course, their very, very, very long winter. So, yeah, it's a good time to come to the lower 48.
Well, I just checking on the gospelrevolution.com website, and we do mention the meeting in Alaska, and then Scott Johnson's email address, so you can contact Scott directly.
Yes.
For information for those of you who may be listening in the 50th state.
Yeah, we've actually had a caller or two from Alaska, it's been a year or so ago, but
is Alaska the 50th state, or is Hawaii?
You know, I
think Alaska is.
I remember both of them when I was just a kid. Both of them actually becoming a state. But I was sitting in front of my computer as I was making some plans about the trip, and I thought, well, I know this is my 50th state, and it would be interesting if this was the 50th state added to the Union, which I think most people, if they are traveling and their intent and goal is to visit all of the states of the Union, Alaska could very possibly be the last one, because unless you, you know, it's not like a place you can visit most any time of the year that you want to. And even at that, as I have found out, there's only about a two-month window of time where you would be guaranteed to have really nice, what we would depend on to be really nice weather. I found out, though, the snowmobiling, which they call it, what did we learn from Sarah that they call it, snow machines, or it's not snowmobiles there, but anyway, that group, they have bumper stickers out about Anchorage that says summers are hell. So yeah,
well, speaking of hell, this story came out while I was in Wisconsin last week, and it's from Wausau, Wisconsin, and this was reported from AP. The mother of an 11-year-old girl who died of undiagnosed diabetes as the family prayed for her to get better testified yesterday that she believes sickness is caused by sin and can be cured by God. Leilani Newman told the jury in her husband's trial that she thought her daughter's March 2008 illness was a test of her religious faith, and she didn't take the girl to a doctor because that it would have been, quote-unquote, complete disobedience to what we believe. Dale Newman, 47, is charged with second-degree reckless homicide in the 2008 death of his daughter, Madeline Newman, called Kara by her parents. His wife was convicted of the same charge this spring and faces up to 25 years in prison when sentenced in October. Let me just finish the story here. I just lost my place on the screen. Prosecutors contend Dale Newman recklessly killed the youngest of his four children by ignoring her deteriorating health. They claim Newman had a legal duty to take her to a doctor. Leilani Newman testified for nearly 5 hours Tuesday, describing the events leading up to her daughter's March 23, 2008 death on a mattress on the floor of the family's rural Weston, Wisconsin home as people surrounded her and prayed. Someone called her for help when she stopped breathing. The family does not belong to an organized religion, and Leilani said they have nothing against doctors, but she said she believes in spiritual healing and viewed Madeline's March 2008 illness as something spiritual. Leilani Newman also said that she did not realize her daughter was seriously ill until the day before her death, when the girl was weak and pale and had trouble breathing. I asked if she loved Jesus, the mother testified. She might have said yes. I know for sure she was acknowledging it. What sounds came out, I don't remember. She was making noises. My focus was definitely to pray. She said she never once believed the girl would die. We thought even the lifelessness was something that she would come out of, the mother said. Everything for us is about faith. It is about trusting in God. We believe in God's word or we don't. A pediatric expert on diabetes told the jury Monday that even right before her death, doctors might have been able to save the girl's life had she been brought to the hospital. So,
yeah, that's like a story from the old days.
That's it in a nutshell. I mean, they are parroting the party line, that's for sure, about either we believe the Bible or we don't, and it's about faith, and they don't belong to an organized religious group. Of course, we would have said we don't belong to an organized religious group either back in the day, because we were spiritual, not religious.
Oh, yeah, none
and
of us.
And their daughter's dead, because, to quote a famous man, it don't work.
My goodness. But you know, the conclusion, see, that's the thing of it, Glenn, is that I agree with the parent, that if you're going to do it that way, then you either do it all the way or don't do it at all. But the sad thing about it is, for any Christian to totally believe that God is going to take care of everything through prayer, this is the ultimate result of it. But people stay trapped between the gospel and what they think is absolute lack of faith. And they stay trapped in this world where nothing is defined. They make claims that they believe in prayer. They make claims that faith always heals. But even the healing people go to the doctor, and all of them's had surgeries and heart attacks. And boy, believe me, the first thing on the top of their agenda was not to pray. They called 911. But the people who listen to them, this is what happens. It's a real, just a real travesty. It's, you know, this is the exact doctrine that I was trained under Norval Hayes. And most of the churches that I spoke at, they would have done the absolute to this extreme. The only thing that prevents things like this from happening is people being shocked into their senses if things get really serious, or just the fact that things they never encounter a situation that is that deadly and that serious. What a flashback to bygone days for me and for you, but the sad reality is it's certainly not the bygone days for many that are still out there.
Well, if anybody's been in this thing, this word of faith healing thing for very long at all, they have prayed for somebody who's died.
Yeah.
And there's always an excuse. There's always some backdoor reasoning behind what God did, why he didn't do it, what God was trying to do. You know, whether it be, I remember when Gloria Copeland's brother was killed in a motorcycle accident in his 30s. And, you know, I mean, these are the ultimate faith people.
Yeah.
And they taught a series about grieve not, quoting one passage from the Bible, that you can sorrow, but you cannot grieve. Because that will steal your joy. And that Kenneth Copeland had a vision of the guy in heaven in his motorcycle getup. And so he had...
What mental illness. I'm sorry. It just amazes me how many people follow the Copelands and all of these... herniated mental and emotional conditions that have come out of this movement, Glenn, and then to have this in the lap of this man, Kenneth Copeland, and to have to defend his doctrine to the point to where that his mind creates some hallucination, if you will, of somebody in heaven on a motorcycle. Dear Jesus. Anything to keep from changing our minds. You know, that's the difference between, people want to know, what's the difference between you and Kenneth Copeland, Mike Williams? I was willing to change my frickin' mind, that's what. When I finally saw so many people dying who desperately were clinging to my words and to Kenneth Copeland's words and to Kenneth Hagin's words, and I watched as people went from ministry to ministry to ministry and looked in the magazines. I got all their magazines. I was in the meetings. And I watched to see the people who we claimed got healed in Norville's meeting, the next month were claimed to be healed in Kenneth Hagin's meeting. And then the following month, I got the call from the family saying they were dead. And I know that this is something that these people experience all the time. This is not something new to them. But it's anything to protect the doctrine, protect the kingdom that they've built. And, man, the suffering and the, oh, my gosh. Gwen, I remember being in a hotel room and a poor woman, a physician, had brought his wife for healing to Norville's meeting in Mobile, Alabama. And she had cancer and was going to Norville's meeting, and Norville was declaring her healed in his meeting. And then she's getting ready for one of the meetings, and the doctor called me. We were staying at the same hotel, and there was nothing but screams coming from the background. This woman, the cancer had moved into her knee, and nothing but screams, wild screams, and him asking me, pleading me for help. And Glenn, I had to make up something. I knew that I couldn't handle that. There was nothing I could do for the woman. I encouraged him to get her to a hospital even then. And but hearing her screams just coming through.
What
on
was
the
she
phone,
screaming about? Was she just in so much pain?
She was in so much pain. She was screaming out loud, Glenn. And just blood curdling screams. I've never heard anything quite like it. I think he did take her to the hospital that night, and they got her something for pain. But then, of course, Norville paraded her back and forth across the stage. Thank you, Jesus, I'm healed. Thank you, Jesus, I'm healed. And oh, thank God. And everybody stood up and screamed, and she was jumping up and down and praising the Lord too. And I swear, then in this particular case, I know in for sure. The doctor actually lived in somewhere in Florida, actually, and then I saw the magazine, Kenneth Hagin's magazine, came out the following month, and they had her parading her across the front of the floor, declaring that she was healed in their meeting. And because I knew the doctor at the time, I kept calling to find out how she was. And then he called me and let me know she had passed away. And it was just, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after Kenneth Hagin's meeting had declared her healed. Jeez.
You know, one of the things that was a linchpin for me was not only the amount of failed results from prayer that occurred, but the people that I knew in my life that were not believers, that were not Christians, that were blessed as though they were.
Yeah.
Like my parents.
Yeah.
And a business associate of mine who were Jewish people who never prayed a day in their life for healing or for prosperity and were as healthy and prosperous and as blessed as you could possibly be. Didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
And living a moral existence without the help, at least on the surface, of Christ. But you recently had an encounter indirectly with your old friend Norville. Do you want to tell that story?
Oh, my. Yeah.
Now, this, ladies and gentlemen, you have to remember, this story is in light of the fact that when Mike first came out of the Word of Faith movement and started preaching the gospel and teaching the gospel, that Norval Hayes said in public that he would destroy you.
Yeah, he made an open declaration that he would destroy me. There were several people who made contact with me and let me know that they had heard him make the statement.
This was your mentor.
Yes, absolutely. It's the guy that I never got a call from to say, hey, you know, I hear you're in trouble, or, you know, I hear you're teaching a false doctrine, and, you know, let's get together and talk or something.
That is so typical that the people that are in the lives of people that come into the gospel, it is the rare exception that somebody like that will get a phone call or an email of concern.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. And it was just a little incidental thing, I suppose. My sister went into the dentist and was sitting in the waiting room, and she kept thinking that she recognized the elderly couple that was seated across from her. And so when she went back, she asked the doctor, after she got into the dentist chair, she said, is that Norval Hayes and his wife out there? And the doctor replied and said, well, yes, it is. And says, well, do you know him? And she said, well, I've known him, that man, for 30 years. Of course, she's referring back to, you know, my involvement with Norval.
Right.
She got up out of the chair and went in and introduced herself to Norval and to his wife, which she's about 20 years younger than Norval. I guess Norval's 82 now. She said he had aged so very much that she hardly recognized him, and I'm sure at 82 that he had. He wasn't particularly known for being physically fit or exercising or anything like that. But they were there together, and they had a young guy with them that I told Donna that was probably their driver. He always had somebody to drive him around. Even back in those days, I was the one who drove him around, and amongst other people. But so she had this chance encounter with running into Norval.
And far from anger or saying that he was still attempting to destroy you, he had some real emotion when she identified herself as your sister.
Yeah, she identified herself as the sister of Mike Williams, and she said that that he had tears in his eyes. And as I was talking to Donna about it, I said, you know, that's the thing that was always so maddening about that whole circle, was the massive amount of tears that were always demonstrated, and yet the horrible viciousness behind the scenes that was executed. And he had tears in his eyes, and I'm sure that it did provoke some real emotion in him. I don't want to doubt that that's true, but it is the utter contrast between, you know, what Norval did and the emotion that he showed there is just stark. Because he did. He called all of the churches that I went to told them all of the negative things that he had just heard about, never checked with me to see whether or not they were true. Once he had decided that he was against what I was saying, then all of the rumors were suddenly true. So, and if, and believe me, if anybody had ever repeated all the rumors about Norville, which had a lot of bases in truth, much more than what was going on with me at the time, there would have been no turning back. That's for sure. It was interesting for me because I realized when Donna brought it up that it didn't stir any particular emotion in me. It may have stirred a bit of sadness. A lot of memories came flooding back of that whole particular time. It's just a life that existed that just absolutely does not exist anymore. It just does not exist. And it's almost like looking back on an old movie I had seen rather than something I had actually experienced.
Mm-hmm. You know, he was always the one preaching on divine health. Of course, his probably best-selling book, How to Live and Not Die, mm-hmm. said he would never need glasses, and yeah. finally gave into that one after having exhausted the largest print Bibles
in the brightest light on the podium and putting his face right down into the Bible.
He made that leaning over the pulpit part of his presentation.
Oh, it yes. He, you talk about good, good at what he did. That's for sure. His whole stance at the pulpit was a part of his character. He would just go up and prop up an elbow, lean forward, almost lay down on the podium, and nobody knew. It was because he couldn't see the Bible. He couldn't see the words, and we always had to make sure that there was a high voltage light in the podium there, and that was something that was always a problem. You know, for the times that he actually used a text, which, you know, a lot of times he didn't even use a text at all. But, and even when he did, it was, you know, a line or a paragraph or just a verse, and then from there, you know, we were off to the races, so. And it was basically stories, one of them was my story, which got so exaggerated beyond what actually did happen that it was almost unrecognizable in years to come. And sadly enough, I succumbed to the the personage of Norville Hayes, of the person that I admired so much and respected so much, and when he told the story differently, then I told the story differently. Mm-hmm. And when he told the story just a little more exciting, I told it just a little bit more exciting. Doesn't excuse my doing it, but that is indeed what happened. But that's, you know, that was true with Norville, with every story he ever told. I remember his pastor, which was an elderly man. Well, Norville called him his pastor. He never got any pastoring from Brother Littlefield. And Brother Littlefield was a little guy, a little old man, and just a charming little character. And and of course, he had always told Zona's story, you know. And of course, by the time Zona's story about her, quote, her healing from her cancers, skin cancers all over her body.
This is Norville's wife.
No, this is Norville's daughter, Zona. But when the story started, Zona had warts on her. And as the years passed, the story developed into cancers all over her body. So, Brother Littlefield, I never will forget this. I was introducing someone to Brother Littlefield, and he said, well, it's very nice to meet you. And the person was so impressed that he had met Norval's pastor. And he said, oh, yes. He said, Norval and I go back a long way. He said, I knew Norval back when Zona's cancers used to be warts. Oh, man, I about cracked up. And just a little smile come across his face. He could always get his point across without, you know, putting anybody down, or at least you didn't know you'd just been put down when he did it. So, but he was a classic for sure.
Well, getting back to the initial story about the family in Wisconsin, you know, one wonders why the purveyors of this heresy, concept of faith healing, are not held accountable legally. There's a place where these guys have gotten this doctrine from.
Yeah. You know, and I guess that all falls under free speech, and people have to decide what they're going to listen to and be affected.
Yeah, but they don't let a certain radical Islamic teaching go on unhindered anymore.
No, they don't.
If they're teaching terrorism.
Yep. And that's the thing, is that this is terrorism, but it's just a whole different. It's not domestic terrorism. It is. You know, it's terrorism of the soul, and it is, you know, it's very profound. But you know, I said years ago, you know, that many years ago, even back when I was still in the Word of Faith movement, which these were some of my parting comments, of course, that I got with my parting gifts, as I was ushered out of the buildings time after time after time after time. But I actually had made the statement that the guys who are publishing these books about prosperity and exactly what to do and guaranteeing that God would multiply this amount of money back, that if you do it and it doesn't work, that they should be that you should be able to file charges against them. For you know, false representation, and because they're getting you to invest money, and that I really do believe should be a crime, because it is talking people into putting money into something. You're not just saying something to people and then they decide, you know, what to do. You're taking the money. You're getting the funds. And Avanzini and was it Avanzini that did all the teaching? And then I remember, you know, telling people that it didn't work. And then he came out with a book after he had raised millions and millions and millions of dollars without giving any asterisk at the end of the sentence. To say, you know, in certain cases and in case of this and in case of that, it does not work. But he did come out with a book years later that was entitled 25 Reasons Why It Don't Work. Which, there's no human being that could have read that book and not found something that they absolutely could not change in their lives that was a preventative from God being able to return to you 100-fold, because it works, bless God. And he wasn't about to say that it didn't work, and so he had so many people writing him letters saying it don't work. And so he wrote a book entitled 25 Reasons Why It Don't Work. And it had to do with everything from saving your life.
Well, it works for it's like a Ponzi scheme, or like the old apparatus in the Soviet Union, the old Communist Party. For the guys at the top, it works, and so they believe it because it worked for them.
Oh, absolutely.
But down the road in the pyramid, it doesn't work.
No.
And it's not because of people's lack of faith.
No, and it was workable for me because I was one of them standing up front, but I just did not have, as I began to realize it don't work and I began to realize why it did work for me over those who were sitting in the pew as opposed to me, the only reason I had money coming in was because I was standing up front telling people what giving would do to them and then taking up offerings. I didn't have any, there was no other way that money manifested in my life. I didn't have checks just show up in the mail from for no reason. Everyone that came in was because we had made appeals for it. And and people supported what I was doing, and a lot of them were giving out of their own belief that if they gave to Mike Williams Ministry that God would take care of their needs. And in the early days of Mike Williams Ministries, we did make those comments. And but we've certainly let people know that that just is not the case. We're not denying that God can provide anything for anybody he wants. But there is not any amount of money you can give to provoke a response out of God. As Paul said in Romans, he said, who is he? In fact, quoting the scriptures, who is he that ever first gave to me that I should repay him? Now that's directly from the scriptures. And Paul was quoting the scriptures. And who is he that ever first gave to me that I should repay him? It doesn't exist. And we take everybody's teaching about it, but we would not settle for what God had to say about it, what the scriptures had to say. I never will forget finding that verse and in Paul's teachings. And and it just blew me away. Who is he that ever first gave to me that I should repay him? That human does not exist.
Well, we've talked a lot tonight, and by the way, this is Glenn Klein Online, Michael Williams, The Gospel Revolution. We're a little over halfway through tonight's podcast, waiting our first call, and we'd love to hear from you. With plenty of time to get in, 1-800-436-3260. Get on the phone, please, let us hear from you. 1-800-436-360. If you are listening live right now, and it's about 25 minutes till the top of the hour, till 10 o'clock on the East Coast, your call is requested at 1-800-436-3260. Sean is waiting to take your call. We'll get you put on the air quickly. 1-800-436-3260. Well, you spent a lot of time tonight, Michael, talking about what the gospel is not and the fraudulent nature of what a lot of people in so-called ministry are doing. But what does the gospel benefit the human being? If it doesn't provide prosperity, if it doesn't provide for healing, if it doesn't provide for marriage reconciliation and for well-trained children and all those things that were taught when we were in churchianity. What does the gospel do for you?
Well, the interesting thing is, what we said, I think, last week, it doesn't even, the gospel doesn't even provide you with redemption. It took the blood of Jesus to provide redemption for us. And the good news of that, the gospel, the good news about redemption and the plan of God that was fulfilled at the cross 2,000 years ago, the good news that all scripture and all law was fulfilled, Paul says will do two things. Now, it delivers you from two things, and those two things have a direct effect upon the soul. There's only two things called the gospel of peace and the gospel of grace. Now, the gospel of peace and the gospel of grace have two correlating responses of the human soul. And one is the removal of guilt and the other is the removal of all judgment. Now, and I believe that they respectively do their very specific work in the soul of the human being who entertains this great and mighty good news. And number one is the gospel of grace. And I think the gospel of grace is what takes the guilt out. It removes guilt from the soul. You don't ever have to feel guilty toward God ever again. And I believe that the gospel of peace, the fact that there is no judgment coming from God. See, some of the meanest people on earth are those who believe there's judgment coming from God, and they actually feel that they are being instruments of God by doing things like what Norval did, by being able to openly say, I will destroy him. And by being able to openly say that was clear evidence that there was no gospel of peace, that there is still belief in judgment. But that really is the gospel in a nutshell. And Glenn, if that's the only two things the gospel does to you, and the only two results that it does for you, that is, man, I would give up everything else to have those two things in place in my life and that response in my heart.
Well, we were talking this afternoon about what the webcast does for us individually, and about no matter how we're feeling going into a program, that invariably our spirits or our hearts, if you will, get lifted because we hear the gospel. We hear it being proclaimed by each other and by our callers and by the subject matter. And it has its place on the human emotion. I mean, it works.
Well, it was designed for the human, Glenn. That's what it was directly designed to do. You see, evidently the problem in humanity was guilt and judgment. Because that's what the gospel relieves, is guilt and judgment. It takes judgment out of our heart for other people and guilt. Now, I am sure that if you allowed anyone of any scholastic achievement of any kind to be able to view and begin to extrapolate as to what the existence of a human without guilt could possibly produce for that individual, and then a human that had no judgment for other people, what it could do in that person, and then begin to build on that and go out and see as what that happens. Now, how does that affect relationship to relationship? Okay, what does it do to two people? What does those two people do to others? What do those others, how do they respond? What if we had a society where there was no guiltiness and no judgment? Let me tell you, just recently with one of my friends, a new friend that I've been just beginning to talk to, and it was so amazing to see the that extreme need to retaliate and hurt somebody with information, and because they felt hurt. And because they felt hurt, they had to retaliate, and they had to hurt. And on two or three different ranges of things. And it was just amazing to me, and this was not somebody in particular that I was talking to about the gospel, but it was like, my goodness, this is just, it is so amazing to be at a point in life where that you can so clearly see that when people strike out to deliberately hurt somebody, that it's because of things that they feel about themselves. It's not even, you know, I can be hurt by what somebody does, but then to have the need to deliberately try to hurt that person, that is another whole realm altogether, indeed.
Well, are people doing that on purpose or subconsciously or both?
they're doing it out of control. And I do mean out of control. They are out of control. And see, if you look at the fruit of the Spirit, that's the opposite to the fruit of the Spirit. It is such a natural response, they don't even realize they're doing it. In fact, I brought it to this person's attention, and they were astounded. They said, well, and you mean you saw that? You saw that I was doing that? And I said, yes. And they said, well, I would have never put it into words, but yeah, I was doing that. And I said, well, I said, you know, the reason that we're talking about it is because I care enough about you to say, okay, you know, this is, you know, what do you want to do with this? Because I was the one being affected in the situation. It's like, okay, I can be either drawn into this, because I didn't have the thing in me to retaliate. So it's like, what do we do? Well, we got to talk now, because there's not going to be, you know, a ball bat, an emotional ball bat coming back at you. So if I'm not going to swing a bat, we got to talk. So it was an interesting situation for my friend, because they had never identified that in themselves at all. But it literally is. There is something. As my experience grows, I still have my woes, my mental and my emotional things that I have to deal with on a daily basis, a yearly basis, or whatever. But Glenn, this has fundamentally changed how I deal with people and what happens to me when there is infliction of pain or hurt upon my life. And it doesn't keep me from inflicting pain and hurt on someone else, but it is, but when I do it, it's like, oh my gosh, I am so sorry that I did that. And, that was not what I intended to do, but, you know, and even that is not without its edges, but such a drastic different world than what I was in before in my religious mindset.
And of course,
yeah,
the relationships,
those two things.
The relationships that are most affected by guilt and judgment are the ones that are closest to us. I mean, it's amazing to me the amount of vitriol and hatred that comes up in couples' lives. People that were once in love with each other, and
yep.
Then they literally seek out to destroy each other's lives during a breakup or divorce because of that guilt.
Absolutely. Feeling shame, feeling guilt, you will have to make the person suffer with whom you have experienced a feeling of guilt or shame pertaining to. They've got to be punished, because you have to do something with that feeling of shame. Shame and guilt are just so hideous. Before the gospel, I just never realized how hideous shame and guilt is and how crippling it is to the individual and to any relationship that you might possibly have, friendship or of any kind. But those two things are, they are the gospel. It's the gospel of peace and the gospel of grace, and their effect is freedom from guilt and freedom from judgment.
This is Glenn Klein Online. That's Michael Williams, president of the Gospel Revolution. A few more minutes left on this edition, and we're still waiting to hear from you tonight. 800-436-3260 is the toll-free number. 1-800-436-3260. Still time to get in. On the website, thegospelrevolution.com, there is a mention now of the second annual Gospel Revolution Convention in Houston.
Yes.
In November, the information is forthcoming, so please continue to be patient with that. Michael, you're going to be focused on the book of Hebrews. You're going to start with the first verse in the book of Hebrews and go all the way through it during that long weekend in Houston. And why is that book so pivotal to the understanding of the gospel?
Well, it is, number one, because of the people that it was written to, it's vitally important to understand it in its context. It was written to the Hebrews. And it is a letter from Paul. I am absolutely convinced of that.
Why is that?
Because of just the comparative style of teaching that Paul does. It is in the book of Hebrews, as it is in the book of Romans and other of Paul's letters, and there is no other apostle who wrote in that style whatsoever at all. And if it
so
was
even though the writer of Hebrews is not directly identified, it's consistent with Paul's style of teaching.
Yes, absolutely, and 100% all the way through it is Paul's style of teaching. And so understanding that this is a progressive story about this address to the Hebrew people about the transition from the old covenant, if you will, to the new, from trusting in the law and all of the particulars of that covenant and refining. It is a book of refining the understanding of Jewish people to help them completely break away from the law and sacrifices and a judgmental God. And it would do well that any Christian would understand this book, because the misconceptions that Paul is addressing throughout the book of Hebrews, and it's one situation after the other. The three main ones, of course, are Hebrews 6, Hebrews 10, and Hebrews 12. Those are monumental. We will cover those in the greatest of detail in context. And as he debunks, it's the Hebrews to me is the teaching that debunks all of the former way of thinking. Now, because of Paul's teaching style, which is to address a subject from the person's point of view whom he is teaching, he does not approach it from his point of view. Now, he brings his point of view around, but to do that, you've got to continue reading. And with the classic, most out-of-context teaching in the Bible, of course, is Hebrews chapter 12 on the chastening and the scourging of the Lord. And you're not going to find a church that doesn't teach that God still chastises his people.
Well, not a quote-unquote good evangelical church, that's for sure.
No, not a one, no. And then the ones that don't do it, they water down the term chastise, and which they can water that down enough to where it just means to correct or show you where you've gone wrong, point things out to you. But that's hardly the context of this reference, because he talks about the chastening and the scourging of the Lord. And scourging literally means to beat and whip to pieces physically, to scourge. That's what happened to Jesus before he went to the cross. He was scourged. And so if they want to water the scourging of Jesus down, then that's all right. If they do the whole thing and just say, well, no, that was just a little correcting that was going on there, or just, you know, little minor taps on the back, that wasn't anything, then that's fine. But you cannot take this out of its context and its the veracity of chastening and scourging and water that down to fit some modern-day Christian objective. It just can't be done. It's either that or it's chastening and scourging. And if it is chastening and scourging, then what is the teacher trying to get across here? So we'll go into detail about that. It is based in Scripture. All of the teaching in Hebrews is based out of the Scriptures and from Scripture reference point to bring it into context in a gospel context. And most teachers that go through the book of Hebrews lift out of Paul's teaching what he is addressing. Okay, this is the way we see it, right? And he'll go several verses saying this is the way it is. But he's not saying this is the way the gospel says it is. This is the way that we, the Jewish and the people that he was speaking with, the Hebrews he was speaking with, you're still seeing it this way. You've accepted Jesus, but you still believe that God chastens and scourges. This is the framework of this entire book, is the presentation of these stumbling points, if you will, where the Hebrew people did not know where to let go of their Jewish teaching and go on into the gospel, and which is basically where the church stayed. And that's the reason that the teaching of this book is so vitally important, is because if it is understood, then those who do believe in Jesus can move completely out of legalism and move out of all of the former way of doing things, which has become a current way of doing things, should never have become a modern-day way of doing things, but because of the lack of understanding of this book, Glenn, we're still trapped where those Hebrews were when Paul wrote them this letter.
Well, we're not.
Nope.
But thankfully. But the inheritors of that legalistic mindset, without question, is much more characterized by the modern-day Christian church than the Jewish religion, without question.
Absolutely, definitely is, and it's just mind-boggling to have been a part of it and to watch it happen and to look at the history of the progression of this. And that's why we do what we do. That's why this is an effort. That's the reason this is is important. That's the reason that the convention is important. That's the reason that we need you there. I need a group of people there that are understanding of the gospel to really get this recorded properly. I'm going to need the people there as much as they need me to be there, and because this is going to be a huge undertaking by anyone's measure. To get through the entire book of Hebrews during this time. We're not going to be announcing any particular group of speakers. We'll be having some other people to share some, either before I speak. But the thing that I have to realize is that if it's going to take at least 8 sessions, that's about as many sessions as we have to get through this entire week. So it boils down to, but what we will do is we'll have some guest speakers, but they'll be speaking before I do, and for 30-40 minutes, and then I'm going to have to keep my segment to a period of time that we can get recorded on the disc. So we're not going to be doing a whole lot of things, but we are going to be working our ways steadily, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, all the way through the book of Hebrews.
Well, that will be quite an accomplishment, and that'll be something that not only will people want to be there to hear it live, but also to have that in their CD library, for sure.
It is, Glenn. It is. It's going to be it really will. If I can use the terminology, it'll be a crowning moment for Mike Williams' ministry. I think it'll be a crowning moment for the gospel, as a matter of fact, to get through this. And then, of course, one of our next goals is to get through the entire book of Romans, which I am ready to teach on. And then all of the others. I mean, we want to do all of them. I even want to be able to speak on the Book of James, and First and Second and Third John, and Peter, because. But I will be teaching on them in reflection of the Scriptures. So even when we go to the Book of James, when I come across places where James explains something that is contrary to the Scriptures, which everybody knows that I believe James explained things that were contrary to the Scriptures, we will go back to the Scriptures and show where James was inconsistent in his understanding of the gospel. Uh-huh. I would do that even with Paul's writing. There's times when Paul gets into things that have nothing to do with the gospel, and it's either inconsistent with the gospel or it just has nothing to do with the gospel, even in context. But we have to become aware of what the foundation for understanding the gospel is. The gospel was birthed out of the Scriptures, and the Scriptures gave birth to the gospel. And it is only by understanding the Scriptures in light of the gospel and understanding the gospel in the light of the Scriptures, it is not going to be verse battling back and forth one to another. If we come across something that just disagrees with what the law, Psalms, and the prophets said, we've got to say that's not what the law, the Psalms, or the prophets had to say. And not be afraid of it. And when somebody starts talking about a future judgment, we just have to say it doesn't make any difference even if it is Paul talking about it. Because the prophets never foretold of a time when there would be a dual judgment, that Jesus would come and do a partial work and take some of the judgment upon himself. The prophets said he would take all of the judgment of the whole world. So we have to deal with all of these New Testament writings in light of the Scriptures, which is what we'll be doing with the book of Hebrews.
Good stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Make your plans on being there this November in Houston for the second annual Gospel Revolution Convention. Well, Michael, thank you so much for all your insight and for your time, as always, and safe travels and good weather coming your way in Alaska.
Yes.
Well, we come to you next week, Lord willing, and if the creek don't rise, Michael will be, is it the 50th state? Did you look it up?
I didn't. You know, I wasn't in front of my computer, so I didn't Google it. But I'm going over now and Googling to find out if it's the 49th or 50th state.
I'm going to Google it right now before we go, so we know. See if anything comes up quickly here. We want to thank Sean O'Halloran for producing and engineering the webcast tonight, and thank you for listening. And I'm Googling. It's happening.
50th state. You might put the 49th and 50th state.
Hawaii was the 50th state.
Ah, okay. So I'm going to the 49th.
You're going
yes.
to number 49.
Yep.
Hawaii became the 50th state.
It'll be my 50th, but theirs was the 49th.
August 21st, 1959, Hawaii became the 50th state.
I remember it well.
The year I was born. All right, well, thank you, beautiful humans, for logging on and
yes,
for your support.
Everybody.
And we'll talk to you next week in the first webcast in August. Time is fleeting by. Until next time, this is Glenn Klein Online saying, Shalom, everybody!